you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Okay, welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. So, this program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical or revolutionary and or revolutionary left perspective. We are, or at least I am, what is it, socially libertarian, economically socialist. For the curious or the committed, posting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy, discussing the means and ends of a multi-tendency left that is of itself and for itself. Meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology, those are the flags of the three lefts. I have here in the studio with me on this special episode with an interview, Slava Rar.
Hello, it's Slava Rar.
Bring that mic down. He's a member of the DSA, and he is going to challenge our congressman in a Democratic primary next year, but he's already started his grassroots campaign. Yeah, so I'll just go right into, quote-unquote, the newsman interview. How about just start with your general background and then relate or summarize your political journey? Like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
How'd you get here?
Well, my journey is not your average journey. I was born in Siberia back when Russia was still part of the USSR. My family, Russian academics on one side, Tatar Muslims on the other, going way back. And we moved to Japan in 1993 when I was 4 years old because there was no food at that time in Russia. There wasn't much to eat even. I remember stories my mom still tells me sometimes about how she had to split an apple between me and my dad and herself. And I would get the flesh of the apple and my dad would get the skin and she would have to eat the seeds. So you can kind of imagine, you know, the trauma of Russian people growing up so much. I was very young, but living in that kind of
what decade place. Was this?
This was the 90s.
This okay. Was the yeah, 90s. I figure the 90s.
Yeah, right after the fall.
Exactly. Everything falls apart.
Yeah, everything falls apart. And my family was lucky enough that my dad was doing a PhD, so he was able to somehow move to Japan. Finished his PhD there at the University of Sapporo. And then we kind of moved around. My family always wanted to come home to Russia for them, but never quite. Every time they would come back for a couple months or so, it was always not much better than before. And so we moved around, moved to Japan, Germany, back to Japan, then to Alabama, to Tennessee, and then finally back, moved up here to upstate New York. And that's where I I finished high school, went to college in the capital region, and then worked for 6 years in the New York State Assembly as a legislative aide to Assemblyman Lentol. Traveling back and forth between Brooklyn, where I did constituent services.
That's his district?
Yeah, his district in Williamsburg and Greenpoint. And then traveling up here to do legislative work for him as well. So I got kind of a really good experience, both hands-on legislative work, negotiating, stuff like that, and at the same time helping constituents with everything from making sure that if there was an annoying tree that the city was taking care of it, or a sidewalk was busted, or the school buses couldn't park somewhere. Things, you know, kind of the minutiae of daily life in the city, but everything kind of went through us. And even going to bigger things like development of those multi-story buildings on the waterfront in Williamsburg, like
the Domino Factory.
Yeah, exactly. The Domino Factory. Sure. Two trees would, you know, come and present their project plans and they never needed, you know, the assemblyman's approval necessarily, because mm-hmm. that's the city council.
But it's more about getting an endorsement.
But it's more about getting an endorsement, exactly. So I got that experience. And then at a certain point, I was tired and I was frustrated with what, you know, when you spent 6 years working in the New York State government and you realize...
Can you relay which years these were exactly?
Yeah, so this was 2010 to 2016. So from the time I was a sophomore in college mm-hmm. until 4 years out of college, I was in that system.
Right.
And, you know, I sometimes say, like, if I had stayed, I would have become like the establishment politician. Mm-hmm. Like I would have been Paul Tonko. So who I'm running.
Or at least an aide of his.
Or at least an aide of his. Yeah. But the path was very clear. You know, you just climb the ladder. Mm-hmm. You go for, you know, the city council, and then you move slowly up. And I thought that, you know, the system that was around me was the way of doing things, and mm-hmm. that's just how it had to be. I never had an outside perspective. But luckily, I left. Not so much because I suddenly saw the light or anything.
Yeah. You didn't have the alternative in front of you, but you simply couldn't abide by where you were.
You know,
is that the way it was?
I started seeing things like, I started seeing how, for example, maybe I had a good idea, but mm-hmm. it didn't matter that I had a good idea because the lobbyists had money, and
yes.
with money comes power. And at a certain point, because Assemblyman Lentil was a very senior member of the legislature, I was beginning to see, like, for example, how the speaker's mind works, how... Mm-hmm. People in that orbit kind of work.
And you might hear the double talk as when I've lobbied, you know, it's like, oh, well, it could be a really small, like a resolution kind of thing. And they're like, oh, well, we won't move on this unless the speaker supports it. And then you talk to the speaker and he says, like, do you have a majority support of this?
Yeah.
Where's my constituency on this?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, we talked to them. They want you to sign off. Oh, well, I'm not signing off.
Yeah, it's always, you know, that's like a standard. But politicians say they're politicians.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they're saying they're experts in this art of manipulating information or our view of what they're doing. So when mm-hmm. they're saying that it's not my fault, it's this person's fault, and that person tells you it's not my fault, it's this person's fault, and that kind of double talk you're talking about, that's like right out of the art of the playbook of an establishment politician who's always
yeah.
trying to maximize how good they look, but at the same time kind of do as little as possible
yes.
to make anyone mad, because God forbid.
Of course.
And I was beginning to see that. And I think that was part of why I left. Also, I guess I just wanted to do something different. And law school seemed like a logical next step.
Mm-hmm. Since you're dealing with the law, and that's usually something suggested pretty heavily.
Yeah. And to be honest, I didn't know that I would go to law school until like 2 weeks before I actually went. I just took the LSAT and I applied, and I wanted to see if I was going to get into anything,
mm-hmm.
and ended up going to NYU and learning from some really brilliant professors. Some of them were, you know, more liberal minded.
Sure. Any standout classes? Or papers that you wrote?
There were some standout classes, sure. Like land use with Vicky Bean. I don't know if you've heard of Vicky Bean. She's was an aide to Mayor de Blasio after she got my class.
I haven't heard her name, but I can
picture. She was actually the deputy mayor.
Okay.
Arthur Miller is another famous one with class mm-hmm. action lawsuits. I wouldn't call these any of the professors I've had to be like. Another one was Professor Hill. Professor Hill's
sure.
Brilliant.
NYU isn't really known for its radicalism, but certainly its competency and experience.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
That sort of gave me an outside perspective. And now I was beginning to see, okay, like actually things don't have to be the way I thought they had to be.
Right. You do a lawsuit and it flips things.
Right.
Even a little bit.
Yeah. And also you kind of see how these rules came about. You know, you study a lot of cases, so you learn a lot about the Supreme Court.
See how messy it can actually be and what kind of interests are involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And how even the Supreme Court makes decisions sometimes based on precedent and sometimes based on, you know, whatever.
The politics of the day.
Politics of the day, exactly. And so after law school, I went to work for a nonprofit called UJO, United Jewish Organizations of mm-hmm. Williamsburg and North Brooklyn. And that is an ultra, well, I don't want to say ultra orthodox because I actually don't like that term. It's a strictly orthodox.
That is what they use, correct?
Community that they serve.
That's the one.
They actually still sometimes use ultra-Orthodox. It just depends
on
who you're talking to.
They're, exactly.
I think they're fine with the term. I personally don't like it.
Okay, right.
Because I've read some articles that, you know, some...
Make a good case.
Some Hasidic Jews make a good case that that they should be called strictly Orthodox.
What's ultra about it?
You know? Yeah, like, why are you...
They're just Orthodox Jews.
They're just Orthodox.
I'm fine with calling them Orthodox. Yeah. In fact... I guess it's to disseminate them from, I guess, other sects of Orthodox.
Well, strictly Orthodoxy. Orthodox. You call
strictly Orthodox, versus the unstrict.
Versus just Orthodox.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because there are, I'd say, my conservative temples, some that were more Orthodox, they were, you know, strictly following kosher law, and then there was very many members that didn't.
Right.
So there's a diversity within a conservative congregation, because conservative doesn't mean the same thing in a Jewish context.
Right. So I started working for them, and they serve a community that is predominantly Hasidic.
Right.
But they serve everyone. They don't just focus on Hasidic people. They serve all kinds of people. It just so happens.
What are their services?
Their services? Everything from getting people help with health care, housing, food stamps, just making sure that people can navigate.
Just a facilitator with public resources.
All kinds of public resources that they might need. Yes.
Since the state departments do such a terrible job of making, if anything, they are required to make them hard to achieve, hard to get.
And there, that was an interesting experience because I started to do some work with agency rulemaking, which is... when like Trump tried to do the public charge rule. I don't know if you've heard of it. The public charge was basically meant to make it extremely difficult for immigrants to come to this country.
Okay.
You have
part of the package that's just called Trump immigration policy.
Exactly.
Which
exactly,
of course is overly complicated because that's our immigration system.
Right. And whenever you make a rule like what Trump tried to do with public charge, you have to go through a process called rulemaking. Which is an agency rulemaking process. And anyone who wants to can put in comments to try to stop this process. Mm-hmm. And that's supposed to be like a check on the agency doing
public
this
participation.
Thing. Yeah,
right?
Public participation.
But and are all these emails thrown out?
Yeah, basically. So that's basically what I'm finding out. You know, I spent 3 years.
Send an email in this process. Email your senator.
Yeah.
Okay, man.
Well, you know, the thing is, there is a little supposed to be some teeth to the comments because you can make legal comments. You can make legal arguments in these comments, and then supposedly, if they still go ahead with it, you can file a lawsuit.
Use them based on that. We warned you.
Yeah, we warned you. You know,
but you still did it.
Yeah,
interesting.
And my professors in law school loved this stuff. They were like, "Oh, you know, this agency rulemaking is great. It's going to save the day." And then I get out of law school.
I raise my eyebrow. It doesn't save the day. I mean, I think it's better than completely closed process. But that's like, but that's over 50 years.
Yeah. And so I finally get out of law school, and I'm like, I have this opportunity to use the skills I've learned to prevent public charge. Oh my gosh, exciting, right? Mm-hmm. And me and a bunch of other attorneys start writing, you know, comments based on this, and I realized that it's futile. It doesn't do anything, you know.
And this is on top of your experience in legislative aid.
Right. So, but I guess I never dealt with agency rulemaking in that, but now I'm dealing with it.
Not to mention federal policy.
Well, yeah, and federal policy. I mean, the state has something similar too. But that's when I kind of realized that, you know, when Trump wants to hurt immigrants or, you know, put kids in cages, as people say.
Or when the government overall.
Whatever the government or he wants to do, you know, you could have thousands of attorneys on the other side, you know, with all this information saying, no, this is illegal, whatever. Yeah. And he won't care and he'll still find ways to do
it. It's not political power.
Right, it's not political.
It's relying on expertise and competence to equal political power when that's never really been the case. I'm starting to read O Albany, which is just kind of an oral history of Albany by a Kennedy writer. I'm only a little bit into it so far, but it kind of, and maybe there's another book about Albany's political machine in the mid-20th century that was kind of locked down. And it's main like So in this book, which is more of an oral history, it's like it's written like a reminiscing old person going from topic to topic. And I'm like, oh, now that I've mentioned a church, let me tell you about this other church. Now, in this case, he's describing like a political committee meeting, a Democratic Party committee meeting, where it's one of the few times of the year that the party boss, Dan O'Connor, comes out. He's kind of an enigma, I guess, but holds immense power, mostly because it's like a family. And it's a mob sort of bit. But all these different immigrant communities, Irish, German, Poles, mostly, you know, just a Catholic coalition. Because they're all, you know, Americans, they're also more identifying as Democrats. Democrats before Catholic and Catholic before being Irish or Polish or German. Then there's, so just the retail politics of, and it's kind of offhand mentioned that they're all very incompetent. Like people are given jobs and people are elected to office, not based on their competency, but just how close and how much they buttered up Dan O'Connor. But it's just kind of set in as a side. It's not a political analysis, just kind of how things worked. And when opposition was in the form of Jews, progressives, and those that weren't able to click in, blacks especially. And that's kind of when the machine broke down. Only after the 60s, when black immigration to Albany began and created white flight and blight from all of the, basically, you have all of these constituencies that enriched themselves and left Albany a cracked husk and moved with their whatever embezzled wealth, I could call, from Albany's growth in the past, and took it to the suburbs. And we've kind of had that legacy ever since. And the only way we'll have any kind of equity is either through state coffers redistributing it, or some kind of county tax scheme where taxes are raised across the county or between the region enough that urban areas that were emptied out because blacks moved in and all the Irish and Germans didn't want to share for the much because they didn't have to. They had embezzled all they needed from the good paying jobs or whatever they got from the machine. It's an interesting kind of thing. And you can kind of see that on a state and a national scale in the same manner. And there is not much of a liberal solution to it as far as just putting experts in charge and elitism / technocracy. We just let algorithms sort things out. We don't have to do people political favors. We do everything possible to exclude these former constituencies. So either they are left to grow more reactionary and conservative since, hey, they were already in a, you know, I got mine attitude generations. And political status quo doesn't really, well, need them, or it hasn't geared towards them, at least the Democrats haven't, or these previous machines. They're still running on borrowed time, so to speak. And like Cuomo, you know, he wins every election, but he's had to resign. But anyway, now let's move on. Very nice summary. So was there anything more? So
yeah, so what I would finish with is that what happened to me is once I started to see the power of, once I started to see it from the other side, once I was on the receiving end of executive power, mm-hmm. of government power, of political power, as you said, then it occurred to me that the toolbox that I had developed during the 6 years that I was in the assembly would be much better used to try to help people from a political place, not from a place of an attorney or a legal place where I might, you know, file lawsuits and go to court and try to stop these actions, but from a place where I could further more socialist, more liberal, more democratic policies and try to think creatively about how to do that and use that toolbox that I had developed.
As a member of DSA and so on, a political organization, so to speak.
Yeah, well, just as a citizen, because mm-hmm. I think that's the role of a citizen, is you have to participate. And when I first started this campaign, I wasn't thinking about DSA. I wasn't thinking about, you know, Sunrise Movement or mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter, like as something that was part of my movement.
Well, how about I step back?
Yeah.
So talk about not only in your campaign, the context of why you settled in Albany when you're doing your kind of doing your law degree and your nonprofit work in New York City, how you came to settle in New Albany, as well as then decide to challenge Tonko or Congress.
Yeah. So, well, you have to remember. So 2010, I go to college. 2012, I finish school. And mm-hmm. that is when I move part-time to New York City. But I'm constantly going back and forth for the mm-hmm. next 4 years. And then, even when I was in law school, my mom still lives here. So I would spend quite a bit of time with her. So I never really left. I was always kind of here in the capital region, gotcha. At least part-time. But yeah, I made the decision to come back full time in order to do the congressional run, which is what I'm doing now, and also to make this my home, and because I want to raise my kids here, and I want to have a family here, and mm-hmm. my mom's here, and I want to be closer to my mom. So I think all of those factors played a role in my decision to move back. I feel much
no,
more
what draws,
at home
what
in
draws
this community
you to,
than I ever
what
felt
draws
in the city.
What draws you to the congressional seat?
In the big picture, I started researching Paul Tonko, first of all. I started mm-hmm. looking where he was on the issues because I've heard some good things about him generally, especially given my background in, you know, mm-hmm. establishment politics. You know, my boss.
Yeah, as far as that world's concerned, yeah. He's the progressive wing of the Democrats.
Right, exactly. Why would you want to run against him? He's so liberal, right? He's so progressive. But I started seeing things that we're like, okay, well, this is a little strange. So for example, he never said he supports the Green New Deal. Well, his words mm-hmm. are, "I support the Green New Deal in principle," which
nice,
right? Yeah, smart. You know, that's a real.
But
word.
Not as it currently is, but in a sense, like his position, as I understand it, is it needs to be changed so that it's palatable to industry, so industry doesn't stop us from passing it, slash, well, if we're going to pass something, it has to be on industry's terms. And so he's made it his job to convince / lobby fossil fuel / dirty industry to adopt some like positive stance towards a Green New Deal. But of course, using that label is smack in every sense of what it should mean, especially the Green Party side of it, but even a Democratic Socialist version, because he's meeting with coal companies and writing in the gas and extractive industry journals of like, I remember reading a part of it, like a why should you support the Green New Deal? Partly comes down to good PR, and you kind of need to anyway to transition profitability-wise. But to me, it's always a losing game. Profitability is always going down. Rate of profit has been going down 150 years. And I think we're on a course that it'll be near zero in, you know, 50 years if it's going on the same track. I mean, it's a janky line that goes down, but it keeps going down.
Yeah, and I think if you ask Paul Tonko, he would probably not say that. He would mm-hmm. probably say that
best days are ahead of us.
Well, or that things are complicated, which is always things are complicated.
True,
and you have to negotiate with the Republicans, and you know you have to get everyone on board.
He's been saying that whole term.
You people won't understand this stuff, you know, because you're not part of the government, or you're not you have never been a congressperson. Mm-hmm. So how would you know how complicated I have it? But you know, my response to that is like that whole complexity that exists and that I saw in the state government, that's just meant to keep people like us from, you know, being able to complain. You know, as long if everything was easy and we could see exactly what kind of decision he's making based on what kind of industry contribution, then things would be easy. We would
it's
be
self-imposed
able to vote on it. Yeah, the complexity is created by the system in order to keep people like us from having a say.
The utopia, I always keep referring to, this reminds me of David, but Utopia of Rules, which is about a left-wing critique of bureaucracy. It's mainly boiled down to it in trying to make, using rules and complexity of rules to create fairness, but it's always reinforcing the existing power dynamics instead. An alternative. I mean, he doesn't really present like an alternative, but mostly just like don't rely on bureaucracy and creating these over rules. even though democracy is made up of rules, but socially created rules, not institutionally created rules, I suppose. What other issues jumped out when reviewing Tonko's record?
Yeah, most of my focus was on the environment because, first of all, something that I think everyone should know is that he's the chair of the subcommittee on the environment. So if you are looking for one person in the entire House of Representatives...
He sells himself as Mr. Green Energy.
If you're looking for one person in the entire House of Representatives who should be a leader on the environment, Paul Tonko is that person. But of course, when you think about, well, who is the leader on the environment, he's not even at the top of the list, right? It would usually be AOC.
As far as mentioned.
Who introduced the Green New Deal. And one of the things that when he says he supports the Green New Deal in principle, what he introduced his own bill, which is the party line, the Democratic Party line.
He's a leader as far as the party is concerned, not as far as the country is concerned.
Right. Or as far as the climate is concerned, I guess.
Yeah. As far as the climate is concerned. See, this is where I'll boil down what's wrong with his position, which from Green point of view, but also just any. He points out like, okay, we're going to make a Green New Deal where we're not even carbon negative or carbon neutral, but just like, okay, 80%, 20% emissions or 8% reduction by 2050, which of course is much, much too late. We have 7 to 8 years. You know, this should have been a discussion a decade ago, 2 decades ago, at least a decade ago, because obviously climate change got on the agenda even back in the mid-aughts with Inconvenient Truth and whatever. But of course, the response from the Democratic establishment was market mechanisms and a bunch of policies that have all completely failed to reduce emissions, reduce bloated growth. Instead of using growth, it's like bloat, economic bloat. It's growth we didn't need in the first place because it's only gone to the billionaire class, something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing about his goal of 2050 instead of 2030, what we're supposed to have, is that it relieves him and the other Democrats of responsibility. It basically says, well, you know, if it was 2030, at least it would be in like 9 years, and we would...
Before his retirement.
Most of them would still be there, but if it's 2050 now, you know...
Pelosi certainly won't be there, but so, and he's been in Congress since I think 06 or it was 08. He was elected 08.
So a little bit about him, I guess, is that he's been in Congress for 13 years, mm-hmm. And before that, he was an assemblyman for 25 years.
Yeah.
And before that, he was an assembly aide for X number of years.
He was where you were.
Yeah, he was what I was, exactly. And before that, he was on some board, I guess.
He's an engineer by trade.
Yeah, he always talks about he's an engineer.
Except he's been an office holder.
Except he's been an office holder his whole life.
His whole life.
And I think that's...
So what does that really mean?
Yeah.
Or I think it means he got a degree in engineering.
He got a degree in engineering.
Yeah. So he can pal around with GE executives.
Yeah.
Because his version of green progress is... kind of large-scale industrial projects involved with the Albany's port, GE, wind turbine and solar production, very top-down, very industrial-scaled. I suppose an argument needs to be made. It needs to be industrial-scale if we've got to make enough of it. But on this program, I've made many arguments / read many articles and pieces about how industrial-scaled renewables is, and it's kind of the approach of Michael Moore you mentioned before, the approach that's like this isn't really, it's kind of a dead end. It's we just don't have enough metals, or we can't mine it fast enough. We can't produce any of it fast enough. The only way out is through, and through is reduction in not so much, in the bloat, the economic bloat.
But if I could even just bring it back a little bit, you know, if you are the chairman of the subcommittee on the environment, and you have wildfires burning in California, and you have this massive drought.
To be a national voice.
And you have to be a national voice on these issues. You can't just sit in Albany and, you know, have a bill and just hold the party line. Like, it's not what we need in this moment. In this moment, we need someone like AOC or, I don't know, Cori Bush or Jamal Bowman.
They're the ones leading the press conferences.
Exactly.
He's not there.
Yeah.
Now, in 08, he was the one kind of, if not leading, but in the lineup in the Progressive Caucus. But, of course, from 08 to 2016, the Progressive Caucus was worthless, as far as I'm concerned. It would be the strategy of, you know, electing progressives, but there would be just as many failures electing progressives to this caucus. And even if it got 20 members, it still didn't seem to matter because these progressives were still, like, with some exceptions like, Kucinich, were just, they were party-line Democrats. Even if, so they were just progressive as far as they weren't completely, they weren't conservative economically, but they were still very much geared towards corporate acquiescence, so to speak.
Yeah.
Progressive meant something very different a decade ago.
Right.
Even now, it means the same thing to me, but at least it seems to be extended to the democratic socialist politics.
Yeah, well, progressive is a tricky term for me. It's
tricky for everybody.
I personally don't like that term because I feel it's been co-opted by people like Paul Tonko mm-hmm. and the establishment, and they call themselves progressives when they're not really. That's why I usually say more liberal or more left.
Very accurate.
But I think the difference between what the establishment politicians kind of view as their job and what I view as the job is this. I inherently view the job of a politician to be different. I think a politician has to be a leader. A politician has to be an educator. So you have to bring people along. You have to try to convince people that global warming is an existential threat, and you have to do that both at the local level in your community and at the national level, and you have to use every tool. You have to do it by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. You have to go on podcasts like this one. You have to go on mainstream media. Any way that you can do it, you have to convince, and you have to reach out to people in communities which generally disagree with the liberal way of thinking about things, and,
yeah.
and to conservative communities. You have to reach out to people in other countries. You have to try to do what the UN has sort of been trying to do, I guess, in some ways with this new report that they just released. But it's
they've been putting out stark reports
yeah.
every time. The COP doesn't seem to follow them
yeah, that that's
strenuously.
Right.
That's the outreach strategy. What of the policy strategy? You know, what wholesale economic? What's the what's the big economic policy besides? Is it just the general AOC Green New Deal, or is it beyond that? Is it more? Are there parts of it that you would put in?
Well, I think that
focus.
I think that the AOC Green New Deal is a good starting place, and then beyond that, and this is something that I think is also part of my approach to politics because of my years of community organizing.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in working with the community in a consensus approach. So,
why don't you segue off ramp? Talk about your organizing then, and what context and what made that up?
Yeah. I guess like I was talking before, I help people with just about absolutely everything, whether
yeah.
it was like sidewalks or trees. I've brought...
This is under the nonprofit, right?
No. This is before as a legislative aide.
Okay.
Yeah. In the nonprofit, I didn't do any community organizing. But
I'm sorry, maybe I'm getting confused. As a legislative aide, you were saying, were you doing community organizing as a legislative aide?
As a legislative aide, I did a little bit of community organizing.
Okay.
I brought people.
I wouldn't describe those things as like together, but go on.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wasn't going to go in that direction.
Okay.
Sorry,
you used the phrase and that like just.
Oh, I see.
I'm not going on calling it a red flag, but it's a buzzword that I'm like.
I see. Yeah.
Obama used it all the time.
Yes.
So I'm like, but he meant it. Well, it's used by mainstream liberals and Democrats
yes.
to mean I interacted with the public. I actually dirtied my hands talking about bread and butter issues or something. Anyway, but what did you mean?
Yeah, no. What I meant is that I've spent a lot of time working with the community. I worked with people in Brooklyn, anyone who would call into the office with whatever kind of help they would need. I did that for many years. And so I understand the value of getting input from the community.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the approaches that I have, perhaps the main approach that I have to policy making, is what I call a consensus-based approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is bringing people in, whoever would want to come to these two roundtables, and bringing in experts, bringing in academics, other kinds of experts, policy experts, getting the people at this roundtable who are all there, like I said, regardless of their party affiliation or anything, to come up with ideas and a proposal for policy change. So,
what institution would be doing this?
This would be through my office.
Okay.
Yeah, this would be.
So instead of a Q&A type of town hall, it would be more of a assembly.
I'm not sure if you would call it an assembly. I call it a roundtable because it's a place where people can exchange ideas and then they can come back, mm-hmm. you know, multiple times, however many times it takes, and they can learn how to create policy.
Have you interacted with in your time in downstate participatory budgeting?
I am aware of it. I haven't personally done it because I think that's usually done more at the city council level.
Sure.
Yeah. Whereas I was in the New York State Assembly. I think that could be somewhat of an analog. Actually, a lot of things that...
That's why I bring it up. Yeah. Because I'm trying to differentiate is the word, yeah. Between what you're envisioning and because a lot of current politicians can use the same language to talk about how they do things. They talk of consensus, but they mean consensus with managers, billionaires, industry lobbyists, and then... community stakeholders. Right. They'll be community stakeholders will be one of a chorus of people with vastly more resources, as if these are all equal partners or equal actors, right? When really one represents magnitudes more people, but the other economic power.
Right. And the reason I use the word consensus is because I don't want it to be. It's not just a round table where you come and if you have 10 people and 6 people vote one way and 4 people vote the other,
yeah.
It's, you know, you just go with whatever the 6 people say, right? I want it to be, if you bring people to a round table who have different views when they get there, but if you put the information in front of them, if you show them the impact that climate change is having on this earth, if you show them where things are going, if you show them what kind of planet their children and their grandchildren are going to inhabit in 20 or 30 years, you can get agreement on what to do about it. It's really something we must do. But certainly
you'll get general priorities of infrastructure,
yeah,
transportation. What I get from many public assemblies is kind of a laundry list of topics to address and then leaving it up to or delegating to experts or people in the field / policymakers to draw up the details. But then that should go back for another consensus vote or a call for consensus.
But that would be
which is how participatory budgeting pretty much works.
Just the bare minimum of what I'm envisioning. What I'm envisioning is going, 100 steps beyond that, mm-hmm. and actually having a proposal that the community drafts up in bill form. Because I've drafted bills before.
Sure.
I know that it's doable. And if you have people who are experts in doing that come and teach people in the community how to do it,
mm-hmm.
then you can do it. There's no reason why anyone couldn't do what I did. And then I think
what's the time commit? What would you put the time commit?
You know, it depends. Mm-hmm. if I personally would commit as much time to that as necessary. I could come in every day to do this type of stuff for different issues around
sure.
different areas in the capital region. We can have one in Schenectady, one in Troy.
Can a mother of four commit the time?
Probably not. Yeah. So I guess
for someone working a 50-hour-a-week job,
some people might not be able to commit the time, right? And so we have to find ways to get them involved, even if they can't commit the time. So mm-hmm. maybe we can spread it out over a longer time period, so mm-hmm. that the time commitment per week would only be 1 or 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And then you have it over maybe 20 weeks or 30 weeks for a certain issue. So right. if they want to participate in that specific issue, then we accommodate yeah. that, right?
And the outreach needs to be like actually signing people up or pre-registering, right? In the same way that for the COVID vaccine. Or if we actually had an automatic voting system, like automatic citizenship of you're going to get the information via email or however contact to be invited to do this.
Right.
Personally.
Right.
The personal ask kind of.
Yeah.
So even if they say like, oh, I don't know, they're at least they know.
Yeah. So this, you know, like as a congressperson representing a specific area, you usually have a list of all the people who live here and who vote here. And you, well, at least of all the people who vote.
Yeah.
And so you
or registered.
You can send out mail to all the addresses informing people mm-hmm. Of these and
which is still about 40%, but
yeah. But then also you go out and you talk to newspapers and you talk to radio stations and you talk to TV channels about these ideas and invite people. So mm-hmm. so I think the thing is like
it's almost like your process or any good process would need to set up its own communication channels, though, that even do a better job than the mass media we have, since the mass media doesn't kind of reach everyone in a uniform way.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Or at least providing the funding / expertise so that this community station can be multiplied in right. even a town of 1,000 or yeah. Every population center.
And I actually think that's absolutely vital to have stations such as this or like a media sanctuary, the kind of work they do is quite brilliant. You know, mm-hmm. they reach out to community voices who you would not hear from otherwise, right?
There needs to be one Schenectady. There needs to be one in yeah. Amsterdam. There should be one Saratoga Springs. Yep. I don't know if they're, yeah. But yeah, that's the goal.
Right.
Golden age.
And then I guess on top of all of one of the distinguishing factors from some of the other people who have had, I guess, sort of similar ideas would be that I would bind myself by whatever decision these community councils would come up with. So mm-hmm. that those would be my marching orders.
That's something most politicians don't.
Right.
They'll change their mind in the vote
right.
or something like that.
But then as I go to Washington, if I so happen to win, and have these marching orders, then I would view it as my role in Washington about this is the right approach and how we came up with it and how we can work with other politicians and other districts to have similar sort of processes. Because I think that there would be a lot more agreement if this kind of grassroots policymaking could happen all over this country.
Okay. I apologize for the popping / static. I've never had it on the broadcast before, so this is definitely new. So I don't exactly know how to troubleshoot for it. I'll just have to bear it, but in the rebroadcast on Saturday, I'll attempt to edit it out. I'll take in the last minutes of this first hour. So you're just starting your campaign now. Do you have a timeline worked out?
I actually started my campaign back in the fall of last year.
Okay, yeah. That's when you decide and such.
That's when I made the decision, and I actually, the way I started this campaign was I just started walking around these neighborhoods, Troy, Albany, mm-hmm. Niskayuna, which is where I went to high school, and especially college campuses, because I was kind of really wanted to see what the younger people, because I think a lot of these issues are generational issues. I started to talk to people on the street about, I had a survey with me, and I would ask them different questions, like, do you support universal basic income? Do you support a system of criminal justice that is less punitive? Do you support bold action on climate change? And then I would engage them in discussions. It wasn't just, you know, asking a series of questions. It was going much deeper. Yes, so going around, I was talking to very people in various communities, and like I was saying, I was engaging them in much deeper discussion. And then what came of that is, I guess just an understanding of where people stand on these issues and how concerned they are about them. And then a lot of the people who volunteer on the campaign now are people that I just sort of met, you know, walking through the community. So one of the things we were talking about before, and you asked me, you know, about DSA, and then I talked about Sunrise Movement, Black Lives Matter, and how I said that when I first started out this campaign, I didn't want to work through any sort of established channels. What I wanted to do is I wanted to create my own grassroots network in the community who I could involve, who I could help create opportunities for, especially people like high school students and college students. You know, one of the things is, of the three established positions on this campaign, two of them are high school students. You know, we probably have the youngest treasurer in this country. She's 17 years old.
Was this through your deep canvassing on college campuses, or did you simply walk by high schools? How did you mean?
The high school students came on board a little bit later, because I didn't start with high schools. Like I said, I started with colleges. There are some college students on the campaign as well. But I found out that colleges are a little bit harder to work with because so many of them come from different parts of the country and the state.
Yeah.
And so they don't really feel like this is part of their community. So I think the type of outreach that has to happen to colleges is a little different.
Mm-hmm. You don't know if they're going to stay in the area or not even.
Yeah, and they don't know, right? So it's a little harder. But I think we will have to revamp those efforts. The high school students, some of them, you know, just kind of found us on social media. Some of them I just know because one of them is my neighbor. And
canvassing just begets more volunteers, more canvassing. That's grassroots organizing 101.
Yeah.
You just have to do it, which is something that it really helps that you're doing this full time. Have you been doing it since the fall? Full time?
Yeah, I've been doing it full time.
Yeah, that's just all you're doing?
Yeah.
That's definitely like something. I mean, I and this will probably be my favorite when I do run for office next time, is that I work very little even now. So it's almost like I could do it full time, but I would definitely treat it more like a part-time job, but it would be an daily thing instead of maybe, yeah. But it means like the time commitment of kind of starting from scratch though, like having a political organization means that through discipline and some solidarity that from being part of an org, based on like, oh, we agree on these principles, we agree on these policies, whatever it is. Sometimes it is the strategy. You already have a base of volunteers kind of there or available. I don't know what's up this mic. It's never done this before. Okay. Is there anything else you want to say in the last few minutes of the hour?
Yeah, I guess one other thing I wanted to mention is, so once I found the volunteers, one of the things we had to come up with, it, the campaign slogan we kind of settled on is raise your hand. And the point of that being our slogan is that we want to show people that they have agency, that they have power in our society. You know, I said before that I view my run for Congress as what a citizen should be doing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing this as a citizen. Ideally what I would want to have is I would want to inspire people to run for office through this campaign. That's why I love working so much with high school and college students, because they have their future ahead of them. They can still run for office in the future. They can run for local office. They can run for state office. They can run for federal office. And I want to make sure that what this campaign is it creates a nurturing environment for them to be able to do that, and an environment where they can learn how to do that.
What originally drew you to what I assume to be a political science degree?
No, I didn't do a political science degree in college.
So what originally drew you to working in the assembly?
Well, that's its own kind of funny story, is I never knew what the assembly was. I barely knew who the governor was.
Sure.
or the senator. I was paying my way through college doing a business administration degree at SUNY Albany. Mm-hmm. And one day I just looked at the buildings. I was like, wow, those buildings are good looking. Like maybe I could earn a few extra bucks, you know, to have some spending money. I walked into a building and the security guards were there. I was like, hey, do you have a human resources person I can talk to? And they're like, yeah, there's a... Oh, well, first of all, they're like, who are you? Like, why are you even here?
That's usually it.
I was like, well, you know, I just want to talk to the human resources officer. I'm looking for a job. And they're like, oh, are you talking about that internship, the assembly internship? And I was like, yeah, that's it. That's the one I'm talking about.
Well, that's the usual follow through. Yeah. So you applied to the internship process.
And then I applied to the internship process. And there was a lady there, Zairita, who was working for the Senate at that time, and she had me up on the 20th floor, went through my resume with me. She was working for the Senate. She figured, she told me, you know, you should also apply for the Assembly, and that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So,
fascinating.
That's I guess that walking into the Alfred E. Smith building was...
Oh, it was that one.
The Alfred E. Smith
fascinating.
Building. Fascinating. That changed my trajectory of my
fascinating.
Whole career.
Yeah, but you were... Did it on /instinct/interest. That's interesting. Because I think through either way I was raised or other things. So I come from a family that's half state workers. So it's kind of assumed you just go through the civil service process and you just get in. It's so easy. It's what all my aunts did or whatever. My mother's one of them dying. And my father was the opposite, where he got many degrees. So he has many kind of intellectual skills, but just does whatever he wants and takes on retail jobs, but ski instruction in the winter and then retail with a friend of his. Yeah. He's just like, you know, a pippy, and I come after him. So it feels like my next, and this is other friends of mine as well, like the next step for me should be going back to school at age 32. But at the same time, it's like, I'm perfectly fine with the education level I have. If I am going to go back to school, it's just to maybe get a teaching certificate. First, my profound thanks for listening, which is a skill as important as talking. So I plan to listen to any constructive feedback, ideas for the show, stories, topics, or rantings you message on Facebook, Twitter at 3LeftShow. You can also email at 3leftshow@gmail.com. This program is made as a part of independent community radio, so support us materially, along with other producers and citizen journalists, with a donation or membership to WCAALP at grandarts.org. Capitalism doesn't value this work, so to support myself personally, become a member of my Patreon, which is also at 3leftshow. Support the show with your time by telling others you believe would be interested, liking and sharing and checking in on our social media pages, as word of mouth is our best advertising. This episode and the last 10 are broadcast on most podcasting apps like Stitcher, Apple Store, and Google Play. But a full archive of the podcast, along with links, sources, and notes, are found at 3lefts.news. Of course, the most important thing is to put the ideas, thinking, and projects talked about here in practice yourself. So be well, keep it rad, and keep waving the flags of the 3 Lefts.
To eat, he wants no bull and a lot of talk that gives no bread and meat.
So left to 3, so left to 3, to the work that we must do. March on in the workers' united front, for you are a worker too. And just because he's human, he doesn't like a pistol to his head. He wants no servant under him and no boss overhead. So left to 3, so left to 3, to the work that we must do. March on in the workers' united front, for you are a worker too. And just because he's a worker, his job is all his own. The liberation of the working class is the job for the worker alone. So left to 3, so left to three, to the work that we must do. March on in the workers' united front, for you are a worker too. For you are a worker too.
Okay, we have Steve Welzer, fellow Jerseyite. Go ahead.
Question for Howie. I noticed that you're able to get published on the Counterpunch site, which is great. I think these days maybe more people are reading Jacobin. Have you approached them? I think your material would be ideal to appear there. What do you think?
Yeah, we're thinking alike. I just submitted an article to them called Escaping the Left's Electoral Impasse. And the first sentence says, whether you're a socialist who believes in a dirty break, a clean break, or no break from the Democratic Party, we all have an interest in pushing ranked choice voting, and particularly multi-seat ranked choice voting for proportional representation for legislatures in the current period. And then basically this is a democratic rights issue, but given that the Republicans have become an extremist party, it's not just the Greens in the broad progressive spectrum that are getting hurt. It's the progressive Democrats for two reasons. One is, in the absence of an exit option, the corporate Democrats take them for granted. And even within there, you know, they were blaming Bernie Sanders, you know, for splitting the vote. The message when the establishment and all the other candidates lined up behind Biden was, a progressive can't beat this extremist Trump. So we share those problems, even if we have a different evaluation for the Democratic Party. So Jacobin rejected it. It's not the first time they rejected my stuff. They did say they want to set up a panel discussion on this. That was a couple of weeks ago. No follow-up yet, but I will follow up with them after this Green convention. So a shorter version of it is coming out in Tempest, which is a sort of post-ISO, more left than Jacobin group that's relating to DSA. And I'll put the full version, which is about 5,000 words. It's a little long for Jacobin. They didn't say why they rejected it. But I think, yeah, that audience I would like to reach. During the campaign, we really had trouble. You know, we had the progressive pundits all out there saying, first they were saying safe states, and then they migrated to no states. You got to vote for Biden everywhere, even in New York, even though Trump is going to lose by a landslide, to stop a coup. And, you know, we would write responses, Angela and I, and the only places that would run them was Counterpunch. Ron Daniels, you know, Black World website ran one of them, Z ran one of them, and LA Progressive ran the first one. But after that, you know, only Counterpunch would run it. Common Dreams and these other broader platforms where the, you know, sign-on letters against our ticket were published would not publish our response. So, you know, we can get in the far left media. Counterpunch is pretty ecumenical, but that sort of left liberal, progressive Democrat, democratic socialist milieu has been tough. Although I have to say, post-election, I did a podcast with Ryan Grimm, who's with The Intercept. And I've been getting other, you know, communications from that milieu. Not a flood, but I think your basic point is right. We want to engage those people in a dialogue, but it's frustrating. I mean, just the other day, Kate Aronoff, who's prolific in these times, the New Republic, she's very good on the climate policies. And she knows that, you know, I've been campaigning for a Green New Deal from 2010. I've been on panel discussions with her. She the other day said, the Green New Deal got started when Sunrise and AOC went to Pelosi's office in 2018. She knows better. And, you know, Mark Dunley tweeted back at her on my tweet that, you know better than that, but So that's a challenge. And that's why hopefully, you know, the Green Socialist Organizing Project can get some credibility and gravitas so that these folks have to pay attention to us. Because, you know, somebody like Kate Aronoff, and she's been writing about this, she knows that the Biden and even Thrive Agenda proposals, which are basically, you know, the same old throw money at the corporations and try to give them incentives to do the right thing, is not up to the job when it comes to really dealing with climate change. So, you know, I give her props on, she's dealing with the international dimensions, the climate debt, as some people, and we criticized Biden's original proposal, which that's how you internationalize the Green New Deal. She gets that. She gets we need public power. But she doesn't get that the Greens are out here talking about that, and she won't acknowledge us. So that's a challenge for us.
Okay, next on stack, we have Rick Greenblatt.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Let me briefly introduce myself and motivate a question. So I'm also from California. I was one of the sponsors of that eco-socialism amendment. I was so happy to see it passed. And I also been working at the local level, especially in San Diego, where I live. I've also been involved with the Green Socialist Organizing Project. So I'm asking this as somebody who's been involved with the organizing project. The question that I have is, we need, and when I say we, I mean more generally than just simply the Green Party, we need to build a party based on the working class, in my opinion. And I think that's generally a position that most people who are socialists believe. I think there are some obstacles to doing that exclusively within the Green Party. And I am a Green and I'm working within the Green Party, but most people perceive the Green Party to be an environmentalist party, which we are and which we want to be. But I think that perception creates some obstacles in carrying out our work as eco-socialists, number one. Number two, most people perceive us as being an electoral party. And in fact, we obviously are an electoral party. But I want to at least state the position that I don't think it's enough for us to be simply an electoral party. We also, at the same time, need to be an activist party. And to some extent, we are. But we also need to be seen as an activist party. And what that means is to be out on the streets, to be in demonstrations. For example, in San Diego, we're working with other groups on the left, including DSA and PSL, to organize a march and rally for Medicare for All, which will be one of about 40 around the country next week. So I don't want to spend more time on this, but the question that I have for everybody here is, what do we do in practice to make the transition from where we are now to becoming or creating an eco-socialist working class party? Over.
I can give a brief response on that. That gets back to the deep canvassing, where we go out and talk to people. If our party is in a particular locality is, say, you know, closer to university based, and not, you know, so we got the well-educated middle class, but we don't have the working class people that are out there. We got to go to those neighborhoods and talk to people. And when I say talk, I don't mean hand them the literature and say, here's the answer. Ask them questions, get them to talk about their issues. I can just tell you from where I live at in Syracuse, I've done a lot of that over the years. And not everybody agrees with my policies. They don't even understand them. But they just appreciate the fact that I've knocked on their door and listened to them. That means so much to people because, the Democrats who have every office in the city, once they get the nomination, they don't have to campaign. The Republicans are the third party in Syracuse. The Greens are the second party. And I run into people all the time and they want to talk about a conversation we had. I've done so much of it that people come to me for constituent services because the counselor, you know, it's hard to get, or they don't know who they are. That's the kind of relationships we got to build. And this is a mostly Black community. I ended up running for the district seat here because on the QT, Democratic committee members, Black people, said, you got to run. Our counselor is not doing the job because they knew me and knew where I stood. And, you know, so that's part of it. But then you got to stay in touch with those people, get them on a list, email. Some people don't have email. You got to phone them. So they know you care. And then you're right. We got to be activists. So when things are happening, whether we initiate it or somebody else initiates and we come out and support, they got to see us. And that consistency is because the biggest problem getting working class people involved is they're not apathetic, they're alienated. You know, I know lots of people who won't even register to vote. Teamsters that I work with who, whenever something came out in the news about some issue, and they, you know, they knew me as an activist, they would come and ask me, well, what do you think? What's going on? They were following politics, but they felt like voting. They didn't want to be suckers to the system because they said it won't change anything. And they had rational reasons for thinking that, you know, the one-party districts we live in. So, well, all I'm saying is this kind of organizing works. And I think if we're going to build, whether a mostly white, green, local that wants to get the Black and Latino communities involved, or we're mostly middle class, want to get the working class involved, or as Michael said, we got the liberal-minded people, but what about these white working class Trump people who voted for Trump because he gave them a phony populist line and they weren't getting anything from Biden? You know, Biden, like Clinton was what was her slogan? I forget right now, but it was like Biden's, you know, let's save our souls, unite the country. And people are saying, I need a job. I need to make enough to pay the bills. And, you know, Trump was making lies, you know, lying about how he'd help him, but at least he was speaking to him. So I think not all those Trumpies. I mean, there's the core of the Trump and the extreme right is the old Dixiecrats. It's that racist streak that's in our history that Michael was talking about. But they're a minority. I think about a third of the Trump vote are people that are lower middle class, working class people that voted for Trump because he thought he'd do something for them. And the Democrats weren't speaking to them. You know, one of the analyses of where our party system is at, Thomas Piketty has put this out there. It's like we have two elites. We have the well-educated elite. That's the Democratic Party. And that's who they speak to. So it's, you know, they're speaking to the people with college degrees, you know, in the suburbs, but not the working class. And then, of course, the Republicans have the business elites that don't want to pay taxes. Nobody's speaking to the working class. So that's an opportunity for us. But I don't think we're going to reach them, you know, through Facebook messages or, you know, handing out flyers. We got to talk to them and get to know them. They need to get to know us because they're so alienated. They need somebody they can trust, and we got to be the people they trust. So that's my thoughts on that problem. But I see Steve Welser's here. He asked me one point in the campaign, why are you talking so much about the workers? And I said, because that's where most of the votes are. They're not voting, but when we do get to elections, that's where we're going to get a lot of votes if we've you know, built those relationships and organized, you know, their grassroots leaders into the party. I mean, that's where we really want to get. So we're a mass party. You know, you read the traditional community organizing stuff, you know, Saul Alinsky says, find the, you know, the natural leader in a community, you know, big mama on the block that knows everything going on. And everybody asks her, you know, what's going on? You know, you get those kind of people involved and they bring a lot of people with them. So this gets back to being good organizers, not just mobilizers. You know, Greens are good at showing up. And when groups have demonstrations, they want us, they tell us, because we know we bring some people. But we need to bring more people. We need to expand our base. So, and, you know, working class people are I think, a prime audience, because the Democrats and Republicans aren't really speaking to them. Certainly not in a way that those people have a relationship to the leadership of those two parties in their communities.
Okay, next on stack, we have Richard Gomez.
Oops, yes, that is correct, I think. Oh, all right. Come on, here we go. All right, everybody can hear me, right?
Yes.
Good. Well, like I said, my name is Richard Gomez from Fresno, California. And the big question I have is, should we be in more of a crisis mode?
We being the Green Party or
Green Party?
In the sense that Ralph Nader would say, why didn't everybody have that fire in their belly like he does?
Well, that's one explanation, true. The idea is that we have to look at this as a, we don't have much time. And what we're asking, in a sense, for people in a, to trust us in a way, because as I understand the eco-socialist system, we're talking about literally taking over industry, even if it's for a short time. We're talking about making a stop from going over the ledge. And we can't do this quietly or nicely. So how quietly or nicely can we, or do we have to be a little more assertive?
I think, yeah, we need to be plain spoken in our demands and make them things that the whole political system has to address. One of the things I was saying during the campaign was, as we go into the 2020s, we can win a lot of local offices because money doesn't play such a big role. You go out in the community and knock on doors, people get to know you. And just the fact that you did that, people are gonna vote for you because they should pay attention to them. And we can, we have over 100 elected officials. We should have thousands as we go into the 2020s. But that's, you know, that's how the Republican Party became, replaced the Whigs over a decade, which is on a fast timeline. They had the crisis over slavery. It's how the Socialist Party and the Greenback Labor Party and the People's Party and the Socialist Party in the post-Civil War and, you know, first 30 years or 35 years of the 20th century built up parties that had representatives in Congress, many state legislatures, thousands of elected officials. Sarah Dillon's putting up Eugene Debs. She's from Terre Haute, Debs' hometown. So that takes time. And what I've concluded since the election is we got to change the rules. That's why I'm saying a strategic priority should be ranked choice voting, particularly for proportional representation through multi-member districts with ranked choice voting, because that opens up the political system to us. And then these ideas we're talking about will have much more cachet. You know, when it's elected officials saying stuff, the media just can't totally ignore them. Well, they can be biased, like, you know, Sanders was dismissed by the corporate media, even as his vote totals ran up. Then they started attacking him. But hey, it's better to be attacked than ignored. So that gives us a platform and we can answer back. So that's one answer, is I think we gotta push hard for changing the electoral system so we don't have this exclusionary single member district, winner take all, plurality voting, which systematically excludes everybody but the plurality or majority in every district. That will open it up a lot more for the Greens and the left. The single member plurality voting, given this extreme Republican Party, is isolating the left. Not just the independent left like the Greens, but the progressive Democrats. That was my argument in that Jacobin submission. So, you know, when I think of urgency, we got to push really hard for these changes in the electoral rules. The other piece is fair ballot access. I mean, I think the Green Party should go back. John Conyers had a pretty good bill from 1989 to 1999. And then for fair ballot access, it was called the Fair Elections Act. And it created a federal standard for federal elections, much lower than it is in terms of petition requirements and votes you need to keep a ballot line in the 50 states. It's still higher than most credible democracies around the world, but for us, it's something that would make it a lot easier for us to get on all the ballots. That bill, Ron Paul had a stupid bill that he introduced later, but it was no good. So I think, you know, what the Green Party should do is draft a bill and start shopping it around. So at least we got a piece in Congress we can mobilize around. So those are some of my thoughts on that. But the urgency, you're right. We don't have time to build up like the populists and the socialists did over decades, because, you know, this climate change and the arms race and the everyday reason that, you know, our life expectancies are on decline because of this inequality. That's with us right now.
Okay. And next on stack, we have Deborah Sousa Oliveira.
Hi, I have a suggestion. I think we need organizing, canvassing, public outreach, phone banking, public speaking, relationship building, training in each state, and then have like a train the trainer to also empower more leaders to create more leaders in all communities. I feel that's lacking. I don't think people have the skills to do that. So we need to teach them how and what that looks like with somebody that's already done it, so they could shadow them and feel comfortable and then practice that all the time, so they become more comfortable in order to build the strength in each state for each Green Party. I think that's really what's needed, because, like, you know, just talking about it, it's not really moving things forward. We need more action, and we need people getting out in the public, engaging, like at, say, farmers markets or like art fairs or community events or anything that is going on locally, and building those relationships that are really crucial and necessary to get the Green Party name out there, because I don't think a lot of people know about the Green Party, and they only know the two-party system. So I feel that if we have those trainings and just multiply it in each state, I think that would be really helpful.
I agree with that. We do need to train people. Maybe a first step is to take advantage of some of the training that's being done. I know People's Action did a lot of this deep canvassing in Georgia. The other thing about deep canvassing, it's the best way to persuade voters, as opposed to the flyby canvassing or the advertising or the leaflets. There's a lot of research on that. Because once you got the trust, then you can talk about issues. And, you know, you run into people that think, well, this isn't a good example because most people have been won over, but people have been won over to Medicare for All once they realize it's not government run, and the government telling you what you do, who your doctor is. You get to choose your doctor. You know, freedom of choice is a big deal with people. And once they learn that out of these conversations, they become much more supportive. I think one of the most stunning things that came out of the 2020 election was Fox News did an exit poll, and they spun the question to make it against Medicare for All. It was, do you want government-run health insurance? 72% said yes. So, you know, that's one of those issues. We've won the public, but public opinion hasn't translated into public policy because, well, we know why. You know, leadership in the Democratic Party is bought and paid for by the health insurance and pharma. You know, look at who pays James Clyburn, who's really adamantly opposed to Medicare for All. He's one of the biggest recipients of that industry's money. So, yeah, I think training, and maybe the first thing is to just show up at the people that are doing it. you know, Wellstone Institute. I don't know if they're still around, but I know a lot of Greens learned a lot of campaign stuff by going to one of their sessions, even though they weren't into the Democratic Party. A lot of these skills are not really partisan. They're just practical campaign skills. So, but I think the goal should be to have this in-house so we can make it, you know, really oriented to our needs. So I think that's a great idea.
Okay, and next on stack, we have Camila Harris.
Yes, hello everyone. I'm actually new. This is where my background is. I'm actually a new Green. I left the Democrats in November this past year. I did the actual Dem exit and became a Green. I was also in Movement for a People's Party. That didn't work out. So it also caused me to remain Green. So I'm really like focused on like trying to be a part of something that, you know, is legit, is for real. I'm also pretty young. I'm kind of like an old head millennial. So when you guys was talking about the reaching out to the youth, that really, you know, hits home for me. At one point I did attend a historically Black college. And one of the things that I noticed was that we didn't have any independent parties come on our campuses. We didn't have, that angle when it came to like issues and those kind of things being part of our discussions on campuses. And so I was, I guess my question is like kind of like, you know, wondering where the party stands on like expanding into, you know, how deeply do you want to expand into the youth base, if you will? Because I mean, of course, the older millennials, we're pushing 40. That's where we're at right now. And a lot of us are like, you know, kind of, you know, disgruntled. And a lot of us are actually working class because, you know, with colleges, people are coming out of college having hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt, you know, and, you know, and things like that. So I just wanted to know where the party stood as far as like the issues that are actually hitting our demographics that, you know, that are younger, you know, I mean, even with voter suppression, you know, I think a lot of us, a lot of people in my demographics don't vote for the simple fact that they're not educated in, you know, every day in their communities. I have an interest in voter literacy and education personally, because in my Black community, for example, like nobody's ever heard of the Greens, to be honest. Like nobody has ever seen Greens. There's no Greens in my particular neighborhood, and I'm in Inglewood, California. I mean, nothing independent actually is in my area, the South Bay area. So no Greens, no DSA, no any of that. And so for me, trying to find out where I best fit, I want to know, especially like with the Greens, like how can, you know, the younger demographics, you know, get involved? And also, how can our issues be kind of front and center? I mean, I understand the deep canvassing part, but then also like, you know, through the national board or whoever, you know, making a bully pulpit for the issues that matter to us.
So my name is Andrea Merida, and you're going to be hearing from myself, from our Green Party presidential nominee, Howie Hawkins, as well as Chris Blankenhorn, who is our media and tech director from the campaign, as well as from Virginia Rodino, who is our press secretary. And we want to talk to you a little bit today about that organism that really is the basis of the Green Party and all of our organizing, and that is the local. You know, we do have among our 10 key values the principle of grassroots democracy. We do see organizing and building the party from a bottom-up solution, right? And so those of you who are involved in organizing and trying to keep the lights on in your Green local, you really are responsible for maintaining the backbone of the Green Party. It's you're the one that's in the hot seat. That's all. That's a privilege, but it's also a big responsibility. And so, you know, as we were navigating through the campaign, and you know, really for over 2 years, we saw lots of commonalities in many places throughout the country and throughout the state parties and what have you. And we often see that there are a small handful of people in every local who are keeping the lights on. They're doing everything in their power to try to maintain, in some cases, ballot status, you know, trying to maintain their social media presence, just trying to do the things to at least let people know that the Green Party exists, right? And that is very noble. And we take our hats off to those people who are really keeping the lights on, because we wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for those people. But now we're at a point where we really have to go to the next level. And that means increasing our membership, increasing the number of basically hands that we have on deck to complete the organizing work that we really need to do. So I'm going to talk for probably another 10 minutes, and then I'm going to punt over to Howie, and then we're going to go to Chris, and then we're going to go to Virginia, and then we think we have another 15 or 20 minutes for questions and answers. So we'll ask you to save all of your questions for the end of the presentation with our thanks. So one of the things that was very apparent as we were dealing with state parties and local parties throughout the country was that, you know, as I said, we have very few amount of hands on deck to complete the work that needed to get done. But we also saw that a lot of times folks didn't have really solid connections in the community. You know, they really couldn't tell you who was working on what initiative and you know, these other things like this. And, you know, of course, the overriding theme of this A&M is anti-oppression. We think that when you handle some of the basic brass tacks of trying to build movement and based on an anti-capitalist analysis and based on an analysis of solidarity and an impetus of solidarity with people in your community, we think that's kind of the calculus we need to be able to build those local parties, again, that are the backbone. And so what do I mean by solidarity? And kind of a generic definition of solidarity is a unity or agreement of feeling or action, especially among individuals with a common interest, a mutual support within a group. And so what do I mean by an anti-capitalist analysis, and what does that have to do with what I'm talking about? So looking at and having critiques about capitalism shows us that the common source of all of the oppressions that we're facing, including the climate crisis, has one source, at least in this country, right? And that is capitalism. And that's a system that's built on exploitation of human beings, animals, and natural resources. And it depends, and it's successful when we're working against and we're pitted against each other. And so when we have an orientation of solidarity, that is one of the core tenets of an anti-capitalist framework, then we can very easily see that we have a common oppressor that we all need to work together to defeat in order to achieve justice for human beings, for the environment, for the climate, for all of these aspects, right? Now, not every Green needs to be a affirmed socialist. I mean, I certainly am. But if you can at least understand that capitalism works for the few and not for the many, it's easier to build solidarity with folks in your community, and it's easier to outreach as well. Now, we have to have an ongoing internal political education on topics of these anti-capitalist ideas and also, you know, things related to decolonization from the systems of oppression as we do this work. You're going to hear a lot of conversations during this A&M about privilege. And what tends to happen, you know, some of the concepts of privilege have been around for at least a decade. We've been having, as a Green Party, these conversations for a long time. And I think, you know, movements like Black Lives Matter, the calls for defunding the police, you know, all of the solidarity around Standing Rock and some of the other pipeline struggles and things have taught us that there is a way of looking at people in a way that requires their silence so that the capitalism can have compliance, right? So this question of privilege comes up a lot. And I have to say that what we are, we're kind of in a standstill as a party, where we're very focused on the issues of solidarity, or excuse me, of privilege. And we've kind of gotten ourselves a little afraid to operate within our communities and even within our own local parties. When we change the orientation of solidarity, in other words, let's work together because we have a common enemy, then we're less inclined to be frozen in place, afraid to say the wrong things to people, afraid to use the wrong pronouns, those kinds of things. So we do need to have an ongoing political education internally in our local so that we constantly deal with those things, right? Because then we can become less afraid to actually orient ourselves in a way of solidarity. You know, so we have to basically, when we're outreaching to the community, when we're building those connections in the community, we have to fake it until we make it. You know, and when you operate from a solidarity framework, then it's easier for you to show up to these community initiatives. And you're not going to immediately start recruiting, but you're actually going to go there to listen and learn. I personally, and I think that is true for my other comrades that are going to be talking today, I personally believe that human beings are good. I think that most of us have a good handle on our empathy, right? And so when you go and listen and learn and meet people and let them talk to you and introduce themselves to you and those kinds of things, our natural inclination, our human inclination towards solidarity, towards empathy, is naturally going to rise to the fore. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. You know, if the game plan that you all set in your local is to listen and learn and operate in a lens of solidarity, then things are going to fall into place with you, assuming that you're also doing your political education. Now, a lot of the building that we have to do is dependent upon having a strategy, and it's dependent about decisions about how we make decisions in our locals. And so grassroots democracy is a thing that we have to observe in our locals, right? We have to do some constant work at looking at our bylaws. You know, do they contain arcane kind of outdated methods that don't really suit the people that we have in the room and at the table at that moment? You know, we as a party, we tend to tack toward a consensus process. And I'll suggest to you, so many of you have read this already, and that's the Tyranny of Structurelessness, written by Joe Freeman. And it's a short document that was essay that was written kind of in response to what was going on in the feminism movement for a while. And, you know, long story short, what it says is that when you kind of have a system that's an old boy network, and sometimes it's an old girl network, and sometimes it's an old person network, and you're not really paying attention to making sure that within a democratic framework that not everybody gets to be heard, then you start to create a lot of strife, right? So within our consensus process, it can be very good as long as you're making the stop around the room and making sure that everybody has something to say. Part of the problem with the consensus process, and why I personally advocate for kind of an up and down vote for everything, and that's the way we do our local decision making here in Denver, is that as long as you seem to go along with what everybody else is going with, you know, the consensus process actually provides a way for you to hide behind everyone else, and then you become dissatisfied because you actually haven't been heard. And so I actually advocate for a lot more, present kind of democratic process. Take that up and down vote, right? One of the dynamics that we've seen in recent times in the Green Party, and if you're interested or working in local, anti-racism or police accountability type movements, the dynamic that we've seen a lot of time is this concept of centering oppressed voices. And, you know, just a quick word about that. I understand the impetus behind wanting to center voices, But we need to be able to understand that what we should be doing is actually listening to people, dealing with the internal conflicts that might trigger, right? But not everybody necessarily is suited to leadership. And if your organization is running democratically, you avoid the problem of having the one person with some sort of an oppressed identity kind of, you know, putting kinks in the work and taking your attention away from the game plan that you all have decided to use, right? So a lot of times when people quote unquote center oppressed voices, what they're actually doing is allowing this person to become authoritarian, right? Whether or not that person accepts what the Green Platform is, whether or not that person is intersectional in their own analysis. In other words, they see the linking oppression between all these different identities that are oppressed under the system. And so what happens is we tend to want to throw democracy out the window because we feel guilty because we're white. We feel guilty because we're straight. We feel guilty because we may be a little bit affluent. And we throw democracy out the window to deal with that guilt. And that's not the way we should be doing things. You have to have a democratic method of making decisions. You have to be very intentional about it. And you have to make sure that your documents, your governing documents reflect that, right? And that's going to come up with, that's going to cause some very difficult conversations in your organization. And so I advocate as well for making sure that you have kind of a code of conflict that you all discuss and that you ratify democratically. You need to define, first of all, who your members actually are, who can actually vote on something like that, right? And I really advocate for a conflict resolution, process or a grievance process. I will recommend to you that the Green Party of Utah spent a lot of time in building this grievance and conflict resolution policy. So take some time to go over to the GPUT website and look at that policy and see if that's something that you can institute. Because the reality of the situation is that if we're doing our outreach correctly, and if we're bringing more diverse voices into our local, the likelihood that we're going to inadvertently stumble on someone's toes is actually going to, you can count on it. And so that's a necessary conversation that needs to be had. But how do you seek resolution for that? How do you get people back onto track? And I think these two documents that you ratified democratically really have to be part of what the local does before they go out and start outreaching externally. You know, another quick word about democracy is we have to be honest about the fact that in many places in our Green Party around the country, democracy does not have the same definition for everyone, right? What do I mean by that? Oftentimes we have people that will participate in a consensus process or will participate in an up or down vote, and they're angry about the outcome because they got overruled, right? And then they start hijacking systems. And I mean, this happened to us in Colorado some years back, you know? And so your code of conduct policy needs to have some sanctions and escalating sanctions, but they also have to be met with, coaching for that person and some educational resources for that person and recalibration. Because one of the things that we've seen as well across the country is that when there's internal disputes, a lot of times somebody does some hijacking. So how can you pay attention to the business of organizing and business of outreach if you're dealing with this internal conflict? If you decide on these rules, these standards of conduct democratically before you really start looking outward, that is really gonna solve a lot of problems. Now, I just have a couple of minutes left, and I just wanna talk about strategy on what your outreach strategy is, right? We have to take time to figure out who is doing what in our community? What are the big issues? Who are the groups that are organizing around these issues? What is the leadership in this group, formal or informal? A lot of times we want to go after the issue that the nonprofit organization is in charge of. okay, you know, there's like sunrise movement and things like that. Those seem like logical groups for us to go after. But we also have to be honest about the fact that the 501c3 structure means that they can't really work with a political party. So what are the other options that you have? And so you have to be connected into the community. I mean, use Facebook to find out what people are organizing around. Check out where the protests are happening. You know, what are the leftists in your community doing? What is DSA in your community, if you have one? What are they doing? And, you know, go to those events, see who's there, but try to do everything you can to figure out what are the big problems in your community and who's doing the work around that. You know, Howie's probably going to talk a little bit about the Australian Greens and their deep canvassing model. And what the Australian Greens actually did is that they drew up a profile of who they thought was most affected by the deepest problems in that community. I mean, they knew how old that person was. They knew roughly how much that person made. They knew whether or not that person was a renter or not a renter. And they did that by actually having conversations with people. Howie's going to talk more about that. So, you know, kind of to bring it full circle a little bit, and, you know, we did say that you have to have a plan for your strategy. You have to map out what you think more or less your tactics and your focuses are going to be for a period of time, let's say a year, say 5 years, and you have to attach goals to that. In a year's time, we will recruit 5 more dues-paying members. And, you know, that's, I'm going to put the dues in it as a little note in the back of your mind, because we have to be able to pay for the things that we do, right? So your strategy needs to be how you're going to deal with the problems of the day, how you're going to, you know, grow your organization with members who are willing to contribute. What is your political education ongoing going to look like? And what kind of events are you actually going to hold in order to put the word out there that the Greens are doing something, right? So I don't want to go on too much further, because I don't want to, what my other comrades here have to say is very, very important. The last thing that I will say is that, you know, I mentioned decolonization very, very quickly. One of the things that we need to decolonize ourselves from as Greens who are anti-capitalists is these notions around productivity. The concept of productivity doesn't belong to us, right? If all you can do in a period of time, say a year, is to recruit one member because that's the capacity you have, then that's the capacity that you have, and that's enough. What you are doing is enough, and you're not under anybody's time frame, right? You can only accomplish what is necessary. So don't get yourself bogged down in goals that, you know, you, if you're honest, you can't really, you know, meet. So with that, I want to punt it over to our 2020 nominee for president, Howie Hawkins.
Okay, thank you, Andrea. I was saying, I want to suggest we need to raise our expectations of what we're capable of in our communities. We need to think about being a mass party that is about taking power in our communities. Because what we're really about is social change, not just being some gadflies protesting on the side and not really changing anything. So do we have in our local a strategic plan on how we're going to take power? If you're in a city or a metropolitan area, you know, it's likely to mean the inner city and the inner ring suburbs. The working class areas are most likely going to be responsive to our platform, share our interests, the people we can build solidarity with, and make up a majority. We're going to have more trouble in the outer ring suburbs and exurbs. But we need a power structure analysis of our communities. Who's on our side? Who are our opponents? I mean, this is the kind of thing that SNCC and the Freedom Schools did. They taught power structure analysis, as well as numeracy, literacy, and Black history, because they were about taking power. So I think, you know, that's the kind of expectations we should have. And just a few thoughts about that is, you know, if you're in a rural area, that's neglected by both the Democrats and the Republicans. All that's out there is Fox News, Clear Channels with 24/7 right-wing radio and the evangelical Christian stations. I mean, I found that out, confirmed it when I was campaigning. I drive across rural areas. That's all that was on the radio. And that's all that people are getting. And they're not getting their economic issues addressed. They're getting scapegoating of immigrants and people of color and Muslims and, you know, Sharia laws coming and all this crazy stuff. I mean, it's really crazy now. They believe Trump won the election. COVID is a hoax. Climate is a hoax. And it's all perpetrated by self-serving liberal elites. If you're in a rural area, how do you talk to those people? So, and give them an alternative. I think one thing we need to think of when we're organizing is, as we develop a strategic plan, I like the idea of paths of least resistance. First of all, if you haven't gotten involved, what communities, what groups are most likely to come with us first? And that's your core, and you build out from that. But I think a lot of locals say, we're a bunch of older people, how do we get the younger people? We're mostly white, how do we get the Black community involved? And so forth. You know, we're based in the university, we're the kind of educated middle class, how do we reach working class folks? And what I want to talk about is, you know, Andrea mentioned the Australian Greens doing deep canvassing. It's really an idea that comes from the United States. And if you go to Jacobin, there have been some articles about that that are worth reading. But we have groups like People's Action that was out in Georgia, going into Trump country, talking to people one-on-one, you know, in these elections that led to those two senators being elected. And deep canvassing, or what they call in the labor movement relational organizing, is you go out and talk to people, but you don't preach at them. Say, here's the leaflet, here are the answers, join us. You listen and you hear what people's concerns are and build a relationship and trust. And this is not the, you know, drive-by canvassing that you do in elections to find out who's with you so you can pull them on election day. This is about getting to know people in communities and building a relationship and trust. Because most people vote with their guts. They don't have a balance sheet where they check off the issues. They vote for people they think are on their side. So how do we build those relationships? Mostly the people that aren't voting that are the people we need to vote if we're going to be successful are working class people who are not so apathetic as they are alienated. They don't trust either party. They know that in our election system, they're mostly uncompetitive one-party districts. Why vote? We already know who's going to win. We get that from the single-member district winner-take-all plurality voting system. And if people don't know to call it that, they know that the same people are going to get reelected who they never see in their neighborhood. So what this deep canvassing is conversations you have, and then you got to follow up. It just can't be one time. You've got to get their name and contact info and be regularly in touch with them. If they have email, that's good. A lot of people don't. You got to phone them. And don't be discouraged if they're not responsive right away. People, you know, they got their lives to live. They may be somebody finishing school or raising a child. But the fact that you've communicated with them and shown them the respect that you want them to know what you're doing, a lot of those people will come around when they have the opportunity. So I would urge everybody to find out what this deep canvassing is all about. And as you get to know people and they get to know you, we've also got to be visible in the community. We just can't be showing up at elections. People will get involved in the Green Party. Their motivation is to learn and to take action. So when you bring people in, don't bring them into the business meetings where you're dealing with the administration of the local party. You know, that's not why most people get involved. Some people like to do that and they're valuable. Most people come because they want to learn about the issues, learn about how to understand the issues, and then take action on them. So when people do get involved, you know, educational forums and activities, and people that may meet us on the street when we canvass, and then they see us on the street or in the public hearings we're in the newspapers, we're being active, then they know we're for real. And that helps build the trust in their ability to have some faith in us. Now, I've done a lot of canvassing in this neighborhood in Syracuse, New York, over the years, running for local office. It's a mostly Black community. I'm a white guy. But I ended up running for the district council because I've been active on the issues. I'd run some citywide races. And it was actually on the QT, members of the Black members of the Democratic Committee said, you know, he said, you got to run because our representative on the city council is not being responsive. We never hear from him. And he basically answering to interests outside the neighborhood. So I ended up running. Got over 40% three times, 48% one time. Probably would have won that election, but the Working Families Party sent in dozens of people the last 10 days from all over the state because they are more concerned with keeping a green off the ballot than supporting their working families, Democrats against Republicans and other races, which is a whole nother story. But what I'm saying is because of this, and I did a lot of door knocking. I mean, to this day, people come to me, not the district counselor, when they got issues with the city, you know, constituent issues. In fact, some of them think I am the counselor, but most of them just know I will respond. So I'm sitting in a storefront, people knock on the door. I just got a phone call a minute ago from somebody in the neighborhood wants to deal with something. So this kind of canvassing, from my personal experience, I know works. And, you know, the political science literature is the most effective way to persuade people to your point of view is this deep canvassing, or what they call in the labor movement, relational organizing. When you're organizing a union, you got to take people as they are in the bargaining unit you're trying to organize. And they're going to be all over the political spectrum. And you got to know how to relate to that and help them find their commonalities. That's what organizers do. Greens are very good at mobilizing. When their actions, the Green locals are usually called because we can bring some people and we show up. We're great activists, but now we got to become organizers. And I'm suggesting that this deep canvassing, it's got to be year round. You got to be constantly going out there and talking to people and being active in the community. And that's how we're going to build a mass base over time. And you need to follow up, you know, email bulletin on a regular basis to those who do email, phone calls. And then, you know, the question is, well, when do you recruit them into the party? And my sort of rule of thumb is when they start talking to you, contacting you to find out what's going on, to find out what you think about an issue. At that point, you know that they're relating to you and it's time to ask them to become a dues-paying member. And then the last thing I want to suggest is that, and this gets to the decision-making thing that Andrea was talking about, consensus has its place, especially in small groups. But as we get large in numbers, you know, working class people don't have a lot of time to sit through long meetings where we're trying to come to consensus. And a lot of times there's pressure to stand aside and really not express your differences over the question that's before us. And a lot of people would rather vote and lose and not be able to express their opinion on that question. They sort of feel like, well, they're obstructing. And also, you know, when it comes, when there are differences, you take a vote. And it's important that sometimes you're gonna lose. I usually lose on the Green Party State Committee in New York when we have differences, but I don't leave. And they've asked me to run for a lot of statewide offices. So, and I'd urge people to take another look at Robert's Rules, which I consider a revolutionary document. It's a revolutionary document. It's a revolutionary document.